Hello and welcome to Rippercast, your podcast on Jack the Ripper and the Whitechapel murders, bringing you the August 2016 meeting of the Whitechapel Society, 1888, with guest speaker Adam Wood presenting Swanson, a year in the casebook of a Victorian detective. Adam Wood is the editor of Ripperologist magazine, which has recently celebrated its 20-year anniversary, and is the man at the helm of Mango Books, which publishes The Rip, as well as a growing selection of what I believe are some of the best books to come out from a single publisher in recent memory. The forthcoming book from Adam will be available through Mango and is entitled Swanson, The Life and Times of a Victorian Detective. For those who need reminding, Donald Swanson spent most of his life in the Metropolitan Police Department, rising to the level of Chief Inspector and then Superintendent. He was in overall charge of the Whitechapel murders investigation and is responsible for what is referred to as a Swanson marginalia, being his notes written in his personal copy of Sir Robert Anderson's reminiscences that named Kosminski as the suspect and described the attempt made to identify him as Jack the Ripper. And so now I turn it over to Tony Power from the Whitechapel Society at the Chamberlain Hotel in London, introducing Adam Wood and Swanson, a year in the casebook of a Victorian detective.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome to the August 2016 meeting of the Whitechapel Society. And I must say, it's great to see so many people here in the Chamberlain Hotel here in Minories, in the heart of the London's East End. I mean, we're in the heart of holiday season. So obviously you've organized your holidays around the Whitechapel Society, which is terrific. So welcome, everybody. I'd also just like to welcome everybody who's listening into this through the Rippercast podcast. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen or heard of the Rippercast podcast, but it's a terrific resource. Great interviews about the Jack the Ripper murders, and well worth checking out. So if you're listening online, you're very welcome. And just to give you a bit more information, if you want to find out about the Whitechapel Society and get a bit more information, we do have a website, and it's whitechapelsociety.com. And there you'll find a list of our future speakers, more about the society itself. You'll be able to see a selection of books that we've produced on the Jack the Ripper murders, and even buy them from the website. And you can find out how to become a member and what that entitles you to. So again, for the base of people who are listening online, to give you a flavour of where we're broadcasting from, we're here in the Chamberlain Hotel in Minories, which is in the heart of the London's East End. So directly to the north of us is Whitechapel High Street and Aldgate, and literally 10 minutes walk to the direct south of us is the iconic London Tower Bridge. And we're in the heart of what became known as the double event territory. So just to the east of us is Berners Street, now called Henrik Street, where Liz Stride was found. And just to the northwest of us is Mitre Square, where Catherine Eddowes was discovered. So we're right in the middle of London's East End. So tonight, we welcome Adam Wood to the Society. Big cheer. Yay! And as you can no doubt hear, Adam is a well-known expert in the field of Jack the Ripper, and we're very happy to have him here with us tonight. He is the editor of the excellent Ripperologist magazine, which is terrific, and it's totally free. So if you want to find out more about the Ripperologist magazine and subscribe to it, that's well worth a read. In addition to that, he's also just started his own publishing company called Mango Books. And there is a selection of Mango books right at the back. Mickey is holding up Crayology. I've got a copy of that. It's a terrific book. And you can buy those here tonight. And if you ask Adam nicely, I'm sure he'll sign them for you as well. So Mango Books produces books about the Jack the Ripper case and about the history of the East End of London as well. He's also written articles about some of the key members of the Jack the Ripper incidents, such as Coroner Wynne Baxter, and he's also written an article about Sir Malvin McNaughton. But tonight, he's talking to us about one of the main players in the Jack the Ripper murders, which is Donald Swanson. And Donald Swanson was the police officer who was in charge of the investigation into the murders. So the title of his talk tonight is Swanson, A Year in the Casebook of a Victorian Detective. I can't wait for it. Please welcome Adam Wood.
Now, we all know Donald Sutherland Swanson from his being in charge of the Ripper investigation, as Tony says, and some will be aware of some of his other cases. Swanson had enjoyed a series of promotions, and in 1896 was appointed Detective Superintendent of the CID, a very different role to that of his days as an inspector on the street. Being superintendent meant it was his job to ensure the smooth running of the CID. Despite being mostly at his desk overseeing the running of dozens of cases, under investigation duty department, it was very hard work. Yes, once Donald Swanson had become superintendent, it was always work, work, work. Swanson would become well known to the public with the arrest of an infamous railway murderer in July 1881. What I'd like to do this evening is to talk about the year leading up to this event. At the beginning of 1880, Swanson was 31 years old, a detective inspector who joined the detective department just 3.5 years earlier. At this time, he was in the habit of recording his cases in his arrest book, shown here. However, the first case we look at wasn't recorded, nor was it reported in any newspaper, for reasons which will become apparent. The episode began when the Reverend Coxhead, the vicar of St John the Evangelist on London Charlotte Street, noticed that pages had been torn from the baptismal register and, believing it to be an act of malice from a member of his congregation, contacted Scotland Yard, who put the case in the hands of Detective Inspector Swanson. Realising the leaves had not been stolen for their intrinsic value, Swanson immediately suspected the crime was a forgery, believing the leaves had been stolen to prevent proof of the forgery being discovered. Learning that a copy of an entry relating to an aristocratic name had recently been sent to Messrs. Feasdale, solicitors to the Duke of Somerset, Swanson went to the lawyer's offices and demanded to see the page supplied. The detective learned that Mr. Edwardson Moore, the 30-year-old nephew of the Duke, had married a few months earlier. The bride had said her name was Lillian Stanhope, the daughter of Thomas Stanhope, a deceased general. The family, sensing she was not who she pretended to be, politely informed her that if she could obtain proof of her identity from someone they knew, they would accept her, but not otherwise. Unable to do so, a few days later, the new Mrs. Seymour had presented Feasdale with a copy of a baptism record with the words, "Sir, you refuse to believe my word as a lady. Surely you will not refuse to believe the copy of my baptismal register." On examining the copy closely some time later, Feasdale noticed that, according to the dates upon it, Mrs. St. Moore had been baptised 3 months before she'd been born. They contacted St. John's and obtained a correct copy, which revealed that the record had, in fact, been for the baptism of a 3-year-old girl. When accused of the forgery, Mrs. St. Moore indignantly denied it. 2 days later, the leaves were removed from the register at St. John's. Swanson began to investigate Mrs. St. Moore, and what he discovered was an incredible story. Described as a young woman of prepossessing appearance, she'd been born Florence Higgins at Northampton on the 21st of December 1853, the illegitimate daughter of Elizabeth Higgins, whose husband John had been a soldier of the 49th Regiment of Foot, but at that time was an in-pensioner of Chelsea Hospital. One William Higgins, wine merchant, was named on the birth certificate. Florence gravitated to London, where she remained until early 1871, and then went north to Liverpool, where she found work performing as a showgirl. On leaving the Alexandra Theatre one evening in late April, she met Edward Goddard, an 18-year-old cotton broker's apprentice. She introduced herself as Lydia Foote, the well-known actress, and the couple spent the evening together and probably the night. Within a few weeks of the meeting, the naive Goddard was told that he had made Lydia pregnant, and only one course of action was open to him. The couple were married on the 9th of July 1871 at the Holy Trinity Church, Liverpool. The 17-year-old bride now called herself Lillian Eleonora Higgins and stated that her father was an inspector of police. Witnesses included Millicent Mary Jeanette Lytton, known in Liverpool as one of the worst prostitutes and thieves, and a Mrs. Morton, whose arrest was sought for theft. The newlyweds moved to rooms at 20 Harbord Street, but when Goddard's father Henry, a respected architect and magistrate, learned of the marriage, he stopped his son's £100 allowance, and there was little choice for Edward but to return to the family home at 122 High Street, Lincoln. Lillian followed a week later and was found lying on the doorstep, apparently senseless, with a small stream of black liquid issuing from both corners of her mouth. Henry Goddard called the chief constable of Lincoln and she was taken into custody for attempted suicide. Appearing in front of the magistrates on the 9th of September, she defended herself, stating, "Gentlemen, I've been taught the definition of suicide is to take away one's own life. I have never even attempted it. My husband was taken away from me and kept away by his father. And with the view of exciting my husband's sympathy, I bought a penny bottle of ink, took some in my mouth and allowed it to ooze at the sides and pretended to have a fit. Had I drunk the whole of the contents of the bottle, it would not have infused me. There I claimed to be discharged, and at once." She was discharged on the condition that she left Lincoln immediately, and she did show, having agreed to a weekly allowance from Goddard of £1. Arriving back in Liverpool, Lillian resumed her previous life as a prostitute, working with her mother, Mrs. Higgins, and Millie Litton. The three were known locally as the mother and two daughters. Keen to rid herself of the weekly allowance applied to Lillian, Henry Goddard hired a private detective based in Liverpool named Maguire. Following her to a well-known brothel on the 70th of October 1871, Maguire found her in bed with a man. On entering the bedroom, Maguire addressed her, "Well, Mrs. Goddard, you seem very comfortable in bed with another man other than your husband." She immediately jumped up and put out the gas lamp. Challenging Maguire, he had no evidence. At this, the private detective lit a match and asked the man for his name, receiving the reply, "No English, no correspondent for me." At the subsequent divorce hearing, a decree nisi was granted and the marriage was finally dissolved on the 29th of July 1873. Lillian moved back to London and adopted the name Chesterfield. She became the kept mistress of a solicitor, who gave her up after a year because of a wayward lifestyle, and she became pregnant by an army officer named Curry, who abandoned her. The child, a girl, was born on the 16th of May 1877 at 41 Windmill Street. She was registered on the 4th of July as Ambrosina Lillian Chesterfield, with the father's name left blank on the certificate. Returning to the stage, 2 years later, Lillian was appearing as Nellie Armroyd in a performance of Lost in London, and on her way to a rehearsal when she noticed she'd been followed by a gentleman of obvious wealth. She led him along Piccadilly and down to Westminster Bridge, where she ran down the steps as if to commit suicide by throwing herself into the Thames. Her plan worked perfectly. The man, Edwardson Moore, ran to stop her and led her away, telling him she was Lillian Stanhope, daughter of General Thomas Stanhope, deceased. The young woman claimed to be penniless and wished to end her life. St. Moore, infatuated with the good-looking young girl, provided lodgings for her, and 3 months later, on the 20th of August, they were married at Marylebone Church. She was given away by John Wurzwick, who was paid 10 shillings for performing the duty. Soon afterwards, Wurzwick was arrested for forgery on a bank and sentenced to 18 months imprisonment. Lillian's desperate plan had been to take her daughter, Ambrosina, to St. John's Church and have her baptised for a second time, this time under the name Lillian Stanhope and with a father named General Thomas Stanhope, exactly as she described herself. On ordering a copy, she altered the age of the person baptised and then presented the document to Messrs. Feasdale. Having obtained the full story and facts of the crimes committed, Swanson applied to the public prosecutor for the necessary arrest warrants. Lillian had one more trick up her sleeve. Swanson was told the warrants would be issued as soon as Mrs. St. Moore had given birth to the child she was carrying. It would be a wait of 10 months before it was discovered she'd bribed a doctor to declare she was pregnant. And in the meantime, the Duchess of Somerset, protecting the family name, used her considerable influence to ensure that no prosecution would take place. As we can see in his private memoranda shown here, Swanson was furious. Thus, one of the clearest and most disgraceful cases of stealing and forgery was compromised. Mr. and Mrs. St. Moore are now abroad, supported by Lord Algernon. There is a probability that this woman will one day become the Duchess of Somerset. In the event, Lillian St. Moore did not become Duchess. She died in 1910, receiving a glowing notice in the Times. In Swanson's next case, he was called to investigate the puzzling murder of a woman whose body had been found in strange circumstances in D Division. Local inspectors King and Lucas, having hit a brick wall with their own investigations, contacted Scotland Yard for assistance, and Detective Inspectors George Greenham, Donald Swanson, were sent. On their first visit to the scene, they were joined by Howard Vincent, director of the CID. Known facts were few. The butler at 139 Harley Street, a man named Spindlove, had found a cask in the corner of the middle cellar at the house, positioned immediately behind a cistern. Inside were discovered the decomposed remains of a woman, dressed in the remnants of a coarse linen chemise. Placed headfirst into the barrel, she was estimated to be between 40 and 50 years of age, with dark brown hair and unusually short front teeth, described as if sawn. A plaster of Paris cast was taken of these. Dr. Spurgeon, the divisional surgeon of D Division, noticed a curvature of the spine, which in his opinion was caused by the body being forced into the barrel. He discovered the whole of the body had been sprinkled with chloride of lime to speed up the decomposition process. On examining the body, Dr. Spurgeon found bloodstains on the rib cage on the left side, indicating stab wounds between the fourth and fifth ribs. The heart, not yet fully decomposed, showed no signs of injury, but the lung had completely dissolved, and therefore he could not say for sure whether this had been the cause of death. Bloodstains found within the cask could have come from either the wound to the chest or the victim's nose or mouth after death. The detectives ascertained that the cask had first been noticed some 2 years earlier in the autumn of 1878 by a Mr. Woodruffy, caretaker of the house. He said he went to the cellar to catch a rat and noticed the barrel, which had bottles on top of it. Woodruffy knocked the barrel with a stick but examined it no further. In July, a plumber named Henley Goatley had undertaken work on the cistern and had pushed the cask into the corner. It's subsequently hidden from view by the packing cases which Goatley had stood on to reach the cistern. Progress seemed to be made in the investigation when one William Tinap said he'd been employed at the house as a footman in August 1878. On his first visit to the cellar, he'd seen the cask and also noticed a bad smell. Tinap had also noticed a quantity of bricks had been replaced on the cellar floor and was told by the odd job man, John Green, that he had laid them at the request of the then butler, Henry Smith. It was clear that the police had to find Henry Smith. He had been the butler at the house for 18 months before leaving his position in November 1878 after being found drunk on duty, and he was now a soldier at the 3rd East Surrey Regiment. Smith claimed he'd never seen the cask, and that he had dug the hole in order to bury a large amount of stale bread, which he thought he would get in trouble for. Denying this, John Green said he'd seen no bread, and the cook, Mrs. Jury, said there'd never been such an accumulation of waste bread in her 5 years in the house. Things looked ominous for Henry Smith, but with no evidence, no charges could be brought. At the inquest on the 14th of June, coroner Dr. Hardwick asked the jury whether they wanted to hear the medical evidence of Dr. Thomas Bond, who had also examined the body. Considering Bond's testimony given in future cases, it is a disappointment that the jury declined. The inquest was then closed with the verdict of the body of a woman, name unknown, found in the cellar at 139 Harley Street, was the body of a murdered woman, the criminal also unknown. 2 days later, it was announced that the government were offering a reward of £100 for information which would lead to the conviction of the murderer, but none came. For his part in the investigation, Swanson was given a reward of 25 shillings. Artifacts of the Harley Street mystery were included in the recent Crime Museum exhibition, including locks of the victim's hair, her stockings, and the plaster cast of her teeth. The photographs shown here appeared in the accompanying book. 5 weeks after the discovery of the remains at Harley Street, Swanson was called to recover a large quantity of jewellery which had been stolen from a house in Fitzrovia in the early hours of the 24th of July. No one had noticed a shadowy figure stepping through the open gate at 8 Portland Place. Slipping inside the house, the man found a suitably quiet spot and secreted himself away for 2 hours until he was sure the occupants were asleep. Emerging from his hiding place around 3 a.m, the man crept into the dressing room of the lady of the house and removed a large quantity of jewellery before leaving as quietly as he has entered. With the Earl and Countess of Bective away, it was several days before the theft was noticed. By the time Scotland Yard were called in, the thief had already parted company with many of the items. Detective Inspector Swanson was assigned to the case and met the Earl and Countess, obtaining a list of the missing items. Recognising the uniqueness of many pieces, Swanson decided the best course of action would be to circulate a list of the stolen jewellery around the pawnbroking network, and so had a notice placed in the Pawnbroker's Gazette. This had the desired effect. Charles Parnicott, a jeweller of 28 New Bond Street, contacted the detective and said he'd been approached by a man who wanted to pawn 2 rings and 3 pearls. He recognised a diamond and a ruby ring worth £200 as one he had remounted for the Countess some 3 months earlier. Swanson then visited several other pawnbrokers in the area. James Moore, an assistant to Thomas Richardson at 11 Upper George Street, told the detective that a man named Robinson had pledged 12 diamonds and a single pearl. Robinson had told Richardson that the pearls belonged to his sister who lived in Ireland. A similar story was told to a pawnbroker of Duke Street by a George Turner, who pledged 3 loose brilliants while saying that his sister needed money to settle an account. Swanson went to the Earl of Bective armed with descriptions of George Turner and Robinson, who he suspected of being the same man. The Earl said it sounded like a former butler named Robert Cumming. At 12:30 a.m. on the 24th September, Swanson encountered Cumming on nearby Charlotte Street, shown here. When asked how he came into possession of a single pearl which was found on his possession, the 39-year-old Cumming mumbled something about buying it from a man he didn't know and selling it to another man he didn't know. Unsurprisingly, Swanson replied these answers were very unsatisfactory. Cumming then said he would tell the truth. He'd pledged the pearl and had the duplicate of the ticket in his rooms. Swanson accompanied Cumming to his home on Weymouth Place, where the detective discovered in a pair of drawers wrapped in tissue paper 4 diamond rings and 2 pieces of a diamond necklace together with a centre cluster. Asked where he got the jewellery from, Cumming replied, "It is Lady Bective's jewellery. I committed the offence." Searching the thief, Swanson found 2 more pawn tickets, 1 for a single pearl and 3 brilliants pledged for £20. The other 3 brilliants pledged for £10. Cumming then removed a further pawn ticket from the lining of his hat. Giving it to Swanson, he explained that it related to a diamond ring pledged for £20. He confirmed to Swanson that he would cooperate in any way possible to assist in the recovery of the stolen items and gave the detective a list of various pawnbrokers where the jewellery might be found. It transpired that Cumming had received just £120 for items worth a combined £3,000, the equivalent today of £6,000 for jewellery worth £250,000. He pleaded guilty at the Old Bailey on the 18th of October 1880 and was sentenced to 5 years penal servitude. With all the stolen jewellery recovered, except a bracelet worth £10, the great Phil Earl of Bective paid Swanson a reward of £200. Here's the covering letter held in the Swanson family archives. The detective was also later presented with a revolver by the grateful Countess. The pistol, a .23 calibre 7-shot Tranter, bore the Countess's monogram and the words "To Donald Swanson, 1882, fixed to the handle. No doubt the Swanson family spent a very enjoyable Christmas following the massive financial windfall, the equivalent of £10,000. The detective started 1881, tracking an English criminal who had committed a series of frauds overseas, but had returned home in an attempt to escape justice. Scotland Yard had been contacted by George Ballantyne, clerk to a firm in the city who acted as agents to Goldsborough & Co., a company of wool brokers in Melbourne, Australia. One of the firm's agents, a Yorkshireman named Mr. Horsfall, had been introduced some months earlier to a fellow Englishman wearing a Royal Navy uniform who called himself Captain Egerton Pleydell Bouverie Tempest. The officer claimed to be a member of the Tempest family from Yorkshire, his father a clergyman and his uncle Sir Charles Tempest. He was well known in Melbourne, moving in the best society circles and in the trust of Horsfall by mentioning several Yorkshire families known to him. Tempest showed a letter to Horsfall, which was supposedly from his brother, Walter Tempest, of 2 Hyde Park Place in London, authorising him to draw £200 in order to provide funds for his return to London. Trusting the officer, Horsfall advanced £250. A letter of exchange was drawn up and signed by both parties. Tempest then sailed from Melbourne on the Cotopaxi, shown here. During the voyage, Tempest borrowed money from the majority of the crew, promising to meet them at the Tavistock Hotel in Covent Garden once the ship had arrived in London. They went, but Tempest was nowhere to be seen. The bills of exchange, meanwhile, had been received by Horsfall's agents, who contacted a trustee named by Captain Tempest. The trustee replied that he had no client by that name, and a clerk was sent to 2 Hyde Park Place to speak to Tempest's brother. The door was answered by a Dr. Walter Cheadle, who said that nobody by that name of Tempest had ever lived at that address. Showing the bills of exchange, the doctor said he had no knowledge of them, but recognised the handwriting as that of his brother, James Cheadle, who had emigrated to Australia some 20 years previously. The matter was placed in Swanson's hands on Friday the 14th of January. He very soon ascertained that Tempest had taken rooms at the Holborn Viaduct Hotel and made his way there. Meeting the captain as if by chance, Swanson introduced himself as Mr. Sutherland of Brighton, in London on business, and the pair spent an evening in conversation, during which time Tempest let slip that he knew Mr. Horsfall and Mrs. Goldsborough of Melbourne. Swanson bade the captain a good evening and left. The following day, he returned with a representative of the city agents and showed the captain the letters of exchange, which he denied all knowledge of, exclaiming, "They are certainly impudent forgeries in my name." Swanson then arrested Tempest and took him to Bow Street Magistrates Court, where he was searched and found to be carrying forged letters purporting to be from members of the Tempest family, asking him to return home, thus establishing identity beyond doubt. At the committal hearing, however, it was ruled that as the offence had taken place outside the magistrate's jurisdiction, no charge could be brought. Tempest was accordingly released and fled the country. It was the latest in a long line of cases where proof had been obtained, but the law did not allow prosecution. Swanson had done his job as a police officer by arresting the offender, but the legal system was not always geared to secure a conviction. Swanson's discreet efficiency had seen him personally chosen to handle the delicate investigations involving the Duke of Somerset and the Earl of Bective. And a few weeks after the arrest of Captain Tempest, he was handpicked by Dolphus Williamson to accompany the Chief Superintendent to Dublin to arrest Michael Davitt, a Fenian arms dealer who was on ticket or leave following his release from Dartmoor Prison in 1877. Davitt had been born in County Mayo in 1846, but emigrated to Lancashire following his family's eviction from their small holding. At the age of 11, he lost an arm in an accident at a cotton mill where he was working, and later commenting that as a result, in the years that followed, he gained a good education. At 15, he became interested in Irish history and the current social situation in his native country, and in 1865, joined the Irish Republican Brotherhood. 2 years later, he became a full-time organising secretary for the North East and Scotland region, organising arms smuggling to Ireland, and took over as chief's arms agent in England in 1868. On the 14th of May 1870, Davitt was arrested at Paddington Station by Chief Inspector George Clark. The arms dealer had been waiting to meet John Wilson, an Englishman from Birmingham, who was travelling into Paddington with two suspicious parcels. After both Davitt and Wilson were arrested, the parcels were opened to reveal a total of 50 pistols, and Davitt was searched by Clark, and a large amount of cash amounting to £7,000 was secreted on his person. Charged with treason on the 11th of July 1870, Davitt was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment and Wilson 7. Davitt served his sentence in Clerkenwell, Newgate, Millbank and finally Dartmoor prisons, and his good behaviour saw him released in 1877 after serving just over 7 years of his sentence. He returned to Ireland with other released political prisoners to a hero's welcome and began a lecturing tour of London, Liverpool, Manchester and Glasgow before heading to America to speak on the newly formed Land League, which had Charles Parnell as its president and Davitt as one of his secretaries. On the 3rd of February 1881, Davitt was in Dublin, busy with plans for a forthcoming Land League convention. Around 2 p.m, he left the League's offices and walking across Carlisle Bridge with two colleagues when he was met by Detective Sheridan of the Dublin Police, who said that Detective Inspector John Mallon wished to see him at his office at the Dublin Castle Police Headquarters. On arriving at the office, Davitt was met by Dolly Williamson and Donald Swanson, who produced a warrant and arrested the Irishman for breaking his ticket of leave conditions. Davitt immediately handed his resolver to Mallon. He was allowed a meal before being taken by Swanson and Williamson by cab to Kingstown, where the trio took the steamer Connaught to Holyhead, where they boarded a train to London. A considerable crowd had gathered at Euston Station anticipating Davitt's arrival. So preferring to avoid this, the detectives alighted at Wilston Junction and changed to a train taking the prisoner to Broad Street, and finally a cab to Bow Street, where they arrived in the early hours of the 4th of February. By this time, the police presence was bolstered by Detective Chief Inspector Shaw and Detective Inspector Butcher, along with Howard Vincent. Davitt's case was immediately heard by Sir James Ingham, and he was removed to Millbank Prison to complete his original sentence. It was a small victory for the police in the ongoing fight against the Fenian threat, but much worse to follow in the years ahead. A month after the arrest of Davitt, Swanson and his wife celebrated the birth of their second son, James John Swanson. He was registered by his father on the 16th of April, but not before the detective had again been called away from London to trace a forger and thief well known to the Metropolitan Police by the name of Walter Selwyn. In 1876, Selwyn had set up an insurance company which invited young men to apply for the position of a secretary by enclosing a £50 deposit. When his manager was arrested and sentenced to 9 months hard labour, Selwyn absconded. He next appeared in an office in Vigo Street, running an agency offering seaside apartments for sale. The scam was a simple one. Applicants would view available apartments on a map and on making their selections would be asked for a small fee to reserve the property. Again, after a number of weeks, Selwyn would disappear with the money. Over subsequent months, Selwyn set up fraudulent companies around the city and closed them just as quickly, until in 1880 he became acquainted with a gang of professional thieves who used him to negotiate stolen bonds. The first transaction concerned £3,000 worth of bonds which had been stolen between Calais and Paris in 1878. The gang had previously used a German named Oscar Reumann to launder the stolen bonds, and finding himself cut out of the deal, the bitter Reumann informed the City of London police, who arrested Selwyn and took him to the Guildhall. 2 days after he was released on bail, £1,400 worth of New Zealand bonds were stolen from a vicarage in Devon, and Swanson was given the task of capturing Selwyn. Incidentally, this drawing of Selwyn is from the scrapbook of Frederick Abelheim, who would later himself arrest the swindler for a similar offence. Learning that each time the criminal disappeared, correspondence had been sent to him care of 119 Ditchley and Rise, Brighton, Swanson began to make inquiries in that neighbourhood. 119 is the house with the green door in this photograph. Before leaving for Brighton, however, Swanson liaised with the City of London police and made arrangements for them to watch a certain address in the city. As suspected, when Selwyn heard of Swanson's inquiries in Brighton, he fled to the house in the city, and he was held there by the city police until Swanson arrived to arrest him. Selwyn was charged with receiving stolen goods, fraud and forgery. At the Old Bailey on the 2nd of May, he was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment on the forgery charge. It wouldn't be the last time that Swanson would work hand-in-hand with the City of London police. With Selwyn finally behind bars, Swanson was sent to arrest George Drevar, a captain of the Merchant Navy, who had spent several threatening letters to the Wreck Commissioner, Mr. H.C. Rovery. Rovery had been responsible for suspending Drevar's certificate 2 years earlier, after concluding that the stranding and loss of the Norfolk and the Cape Verde Islands had been the result of negligence on the part of Drevar, its captain. Drevar held the commissioner personally responsible for its inability to reclaim his logbook, which would show the accident was not his fault. He claimed the suspension of his certificate for 6 months had ruined him. In one of the letters, Drevar called Rovery a modern Jesuit and said that desperate remedies were required for desperate wrongs. He demanded recompense, employment or an asylum, and said if he did not get what he wanted, he was charged his blood and that of another on the nation that so cruelly wronged him. Captain Drevar was well known to the public, and if Swanson felt a little unsure what to expect when visiting him, it would not have been a surprise. In 1876, Drevar had been captain of the barque Pauline, which was carrying coals for HM Naval Stars in Zanzibar, and on the 8th of July was off the northeast coast of Brazil when the crew observed some black spots on the water and a whitish pillar about 30 feet high rising above them. Using binoculars, Captain Drevar saw a monster sea serpent coiled twice around a large sperm whale. His description was reported in several excited newspapers, with this sketch published in the Illustrated London News. Drevar's description was as follows. The head and tail parts, each about 30 feet long, were acting as levers, twisting itself and victim around with great velocity. They sank out of sight about every 2 minutes, coming to the surface, still revolving. And the struggles of the whale and two other whales that were near, frantic with excitement, made the sea in their vicinity like a boiling cauldron. This strange occurrence lasted some 15 minutes, and finished with the tail portion of the whale being elevated straight in the air, then waving backwards and forwards and lashing the water furiously in the last-death struggle, when the whole body disappeared from our view, going down head foremost at the bottom, where no doubt it was gorged at the serpent's leisure, and that monster of monsters may have spent many months in a state of coma digesting the huge mouthful. Allowing for two coils around the whale, I think the serpent was around 160 or 170 feet long and 7 or 8 feet in girth. The Pauline arrived back in Liverpool on the 16th of January 1877, having spent a total of 20 months at sea. Drevar at once went to Liverpool Police Court, where he made a sworn affidavit as to the sightings of the sea serpent. Drevar claimed to have been invited to London by several scientific societies in order to relate what he had seen. Whether he attended such a meeting is unknown, but he subsequently became captain of the Norfolk, a London-based vessel. When Swanson visited Drevar and told him he was under arrest, the latter said he might go to court and shoot the Wreck Commissioner on the bench. He admitted writing the letters, saying he did so partly because of the insults received from Mr. Rovery, and partly due to the fact he believed he was doing the Almighty's work in making his wonders known. He
He then showed the detective a smaller serpent, which he claimed had been caught by a crew member off South Africa. It was some 4 or 5 feet long and of peculiar formation, kept in spirits in a glass bottle. Sea serpents notwithstanding, Drevor still threatened Mr. Rovery, and at the Old Bailey on the 6th of May, 1881, he was sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment. But Drevor was far from a crazed sea dog. He'd long been interested in lifeboats and other life-preserving craft, and had invented a water velocipede, which he patented on the 16th of January, 1877. The machine, a paddle lifeboat which could be constructed within 10 minutes, consisted of common items such as a wine packing case and a sawn barrel. After exhibiting this in 1882, the following year it was reported that Captain Drevor had made several attempts to cross the channel from Dover in his paddle boat, and another invention, a boat made out of a tub affixed to a wooden frame acting as a raft. Both vessels were intended as life-saving equipment, and Drevor's cross-channel crossings were merely marketing ploys, which each time resulted in him pulled from the water by various fishing boats. In many of these endeavours, he was assisted by Mr. Ward, whose son Alfred donned another Drevor invention, a waterproof costume. George Drevor eventually emigrated to Australia, where he became a showman at the Royal Aquarium Pleasure Gardens at Sydney, as well as working at the recently opened Centennial Park, where he offered his cask boats for rent to pleasure seekers. On New Year's Day 1890, he was on the shoreline of a dam at Centennial Park, where he saw a buoy in one of his casks capsize and begin to sink. Drevor, some 200 yards away, ran to the water's edge and jumped in. As he reached the buoy, both sank. A witness dived in and saved the lad, but Drevor drowned. It was an ironic way for the master mariner to meet his end. One suspect that Donald Swanson looked back on his encounter with Drevor with pleasure, a note in his arrest book shown here, recorded the captain as Sea Serpent Man. By the time Drevor had been released from prison, the name of Inspector Swanson had become known across the country following his arrest of the killer of Frederick Isaac Gold on the London to Brighton train on the afternoon of the 27th of June. 11 days after the murder, Swanson was standing opposite 32 Smith Street in Stepney with Inspector Frederick Jarvis, and those who were on Neil's work earlier today stood on the same spot. At around 7:45 in the evening, Swanson saw Jane Bickers walk up the path toward the front door. As Miss Bickers opened the door of number 32 and went in, Swanson followed and entered at the same time. He was met by her mother, Sarah Bickers, whom the detective took into the parlour and stated the nature of his visit. He was told the man he was interested in was at that moment in his room on the first floor. Swanson climbed the staircase, telling Detective Inspector Jarvis to stay downstairs guarding the front door. He quickly opened the door to the first room and saw a pale, thin man sitting in an armchair. Percy Lefroy Mapleton? Yes, I expected you. The subsequent trial and execution of Lefroy would be covered by the newspapers for months to come, putting Swanson firmly in the spotlight. His career was supposed to really go from strength to strength until, as we'd heard, he was appointed Detective Superintendent of the CID, a position he held until his retirement in 1903. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the year, a typical year in the life of a Victorian detective. The odd murder, lots of frauds, forgeries and thefts, but probably not too many sea serpents, though. Thank you very much.
OK, we're going to take a short break here, about 15 minutes. Go and charge your glasses. And then when we come back, we'll take a few questions. All right? Thanks a lot, everyone.
Any questions that you have, please put your hand up and then Adam will answer them for you. So has anybody got a question that they'd like to ask Adam about the presentation or about anything else in his life, really?
It strikes me from looking at that selection of cases that you brought, which are obviously for 1 year, that they were ones that through painstaking sort of detective work you could follow a line of evidence to track someone down, which is obviously very different from the Ripper crimes that didn't have that obvious evidence train to follow. And it strikes me from that presentation you gave that the detailed police work that they were capable of didn't equip them at all for anything like the Ripper murders. Would you agree with that?
That's a very difficult question to answer, obviously, but I think the thing to remember is that at the time Swanson was appointed, if you're talking about Swanson rather than the Ripper investigation generally, Swanson was appointed to one case from Scotland Yard, whereas it was dealt with locally beforehand. The Warren memo certainly appoints him for that one case, and he was held in situ from there.
I feel that Swanson probably looked at the evidence that he had available, couldn't find an obvious respect. I mean, the cases we had there, you have to remember, Swanson was quite a new detective inspector. A lot of the cases were probably obvious solutions to them. I think you're probably fair in saying that the detectives, certainly in Swanson's case, maybe weren't prepared for the lack of evidence that they could easily follow. And the number of suspects that were probably put their way, they ought to obviously follow every lead and investigate those to one way or another to dismiss them, probably in most cases. The work still had to be put in, but it's difficult to say whether they were prepared in advance for that or not.
He obviously wrote a lot of sort of composite reports during the Ripper case as well, and he obviously was used to doing very detailed work from those other cases and other years as well. Obviously, that was just one year. And some people have sort of mocked his, if that's the right word, his detail, his attention to detail in some of the reports. Would you say they're fair criticisms or unfair criticisms?
Yes, I would. I mean, I've been very fortunate in while researching the book, in that the family were doubly fortunate. One, in that they've retained so many papers and files and letters, and secondly, that they've let me see everything. And I would say that almost every aspect of his life is really well documented. I mean, some of the letters that he's written, just sort of personal, on a personal basis, he's detailing the way he feels or what he's done in incredible detail that no normal person would probably do. And I think it probably was his detective training and his logging everything that he's probably feeling and everything that he's doing. His punctuation isn't brilliant, to be honest, on some of the reports especially, and you can sometimes read two different ways that he's saying in some of those reports. But no, I think he's very, very meticulous, and perhaps some of the criticism he's had, I know I have the benefit of seeing a lot of documents that nobody else has ever seen, so probably on the evidence that the general person can see, I can see where that criticism might come from, but in my opinion, it's unfounded.
I have a two-part question. He received money as like a reward, but wouldn't that be treated as a bribery? And was that the case across the whole of the police division? They received money for a result?
I think it's quite common that the police would be given a reward or an award of some type. I don't know if you could call it a reward if it was like an unsolved case like Harley Street. But I'm going to have to ask, if he doesn't mind, I have to ask Neil, who know more about the etiquette or the rules, if you like, of a police being given a monetary reward.
Basically, there was a pot at court where money was put in by local businessmen, shop owners, so on and so forth, and that was the reward pot, and that would be divvied out. Basically, what would happen would be that the policeman's superior would recommend him for an award, and the magistrate or judge or whatever would agree or disagree, and the set amount would be given out. So in this particular case, it looks like it was given to Swanson directly, but it would be on the authorisation of his senior officer for whether he deserved it, first of all, and whether he should accept it. As long as it's actually noted down in gratuities, there's not a problem.
Did you know if Swanson was from London? But and if so, would his local knowledge of the certain crime, criminals and that have helped him?
No, he was actually from Thurso, at the very far north of Scotland. His local knowledge wasn't that good at the time, but he moved to London when he was 19 and started working as a clerk in a city. And after a year, his employer decided to retire and gave up business. So Swanson literally didn't have an intention to join the Met when he first moved to London. Saw an advert in the Daily Telegraph on the day he was told that he was losing his job and just applied on the back of that. But he was 19 and retired when he was 56. Obviously, he was well suited to the work.
What made you interested in Swanson? Why have you done all this research actually on Swanson and not Abberline or anyone else?
As Tony said in his introduction, I've written quite a few articles about some of the characters. Baxter and McNaughton have researched their lives and careers. I did a similar article for Ripperologist magazine on the Swanson marginalia, but I was halfway through that research and I was told that the Swanson family live quite close to me in Worcester, and would I like to be put in touch with them to do more research on the marginalia? Of course, I said yes, and when I met Neville Swanson, he said, well, we've got basically a whole archive of his materials. Would you like to come and see it? Yeah, so effectively, I finished the article on the marginalia, but I realised that there was so much to this guy, not only that he did, but was available to be turned into research and turned into a book. So when I finished the article in 2012, I asked the family, would they be okay me continuing to look through their archives and write a biography? Obviously, they're very, very happy to do so. So 4 years later, I'm still writing it.
Did he ever disclose to, like, his descendants? Is there any family story about who the Ripper might have been? We know about the Swanson marginalia. Obviously, is there anything in the family to say he might have known who it was?
Well, the stories that we hear from the family now, I mean, there's one surviving granddaughter, and beyond that is great-great-grandchildren. But Mary Birkin, who's the last surviving grandchild of Donald Swanson, grew up with her father, who's his eldest son, she says it was well known in the family that the identity of the Ripper was known, but they didn't say it was definitely Kosminski, because at the time the family didn't know anything about the marginalia until it was discovered. But there was a feeling in the family that the case had been solved, he knew who it was, simple as that, but they didn't ask anymore. And he certainly, apparently Donald Swanson certainly wouldn't tell anyone in the family this is who it was. He didn't sort of tell tales out of school, as his grandson James Swanson said. It was just an understanding in the family that, yep, they knew it was. It wasn't made public. It wasn't an arrest or an imprisonment. And when the marginalia was discovered in 1981, they just put two and two together and said, well, that's what the understanding was. So there's possibly his eldest son, Donald Neville Swanson, did know about the marginalia. He did know about Kosminski, but none of the other documentation has come down through the family.
Yeah, Adam, do you intend doing any research into Swanson? And no. If you do, would you consider publishing a book on the subject?
It's crossed my mind, yeah, in the past, yeah.
The gun, would that have been in the book of whatever you said it was, the book of allowable things? Would that have been? Seems a bit of a strange one, doesn't it?
Yeah, the book of gratuities. I don't know, to be honest with you. It's not something I've come across. It's purely monetary.
Whether that being treated as a gift?
Yeah,
personal gift, yeah, rather than a reward.
Be a gift. Again, it would have had to have gone through the seniors at Scotland Yard. What the interesting thing is, was he trained to use a gun? Do you know that it was ever used?
Jim Swanson, the grandson, wrote some letters to... This is part of the research for the marginalia. Wrote some letters to Paul Begg in the 1980s. And he said that apparently Donald Swanson kept a pistol in his retirement. Don't know if it's the same one. Kept a pistol for fear of reprisals from the Fenian cases that he was involved in the mid-1980s. Neville Swanson doesn't know anything about another gun apart from the one which has been returned to the family recently.
All policemen in the Met, I'm assuming the city, were trained to use them. They were trained at the firing range at Wormwood Scrubs and Peckham Lane, I think it was, Peckham Rye Lane or something like that. So it would be interesting to find out if Swanson was actually trained on it. If he wasn't professionally trained, then it would have been obviously on his own bat, you know, as an amateur. It's interesting.
His youngest son, just to finish on that, his youngest son, he went to the grave the other day, his youngest son was actually a crack shot, and I think during some national championships in the 1920s was sort of generally first and second place all the time. Excellent marksman for the local gun club. So whether that was sort of some involvement from Donald Swanson or just something he did off his own back, I don't know.
Okay, unless there's any more questions, there's just one more question that I'm going to ask, which is, obviously you're writing the book. When do you hope to publish it?
Well, the good news is that I've been writing it for a long time, but the good news is that Swanson's now dead. So I've just got the final chapter is the research and my take on the seaside home, which I presented obviously in December, Kosminski and the identification. So that might take a little bit of time. I'm hoping to get it out before Christmas, but the problem is that the printer that I use in the publishing department, they're very, very busy. Once you get to November, if you don't get a book in by November, you're going to miss the Christmas market. So it may come out in January, as Crayology did last year. So I may finish it within the next couple of months, but it may be January before it's published.
Thanks, everybody. Adam Wood.
And that was Adam Wood speaking at the August 2016 meeting of the Whitechapel Society. I'd like to thank Mr. Wood, the Whitechapel Society, and especially our fill-in sound man, Paul Noble, for making this release possible. The access that the Whitechapel Society, the U.S. Ripper Conference, Frog Moody, and Casebook Classic Crime have all gave to this podcast really is a blessing, in my opinion, in allowing people from all around the world to hear for free such a wide selection of the best presentations on Victorian and Edwardian true crime. And I couldn't be more grateful to all of them for that privilege, so thank you again. If you would like more information about the Whitechapel Society, as Tony said, please go to whitechapelsociety.com. To check out the books available from Mango, visit mangobooks.co.uk. And if you'd like to begin receiving your free bi-monthly copy of Ripperologist magazine, email contact@ripperologist.biz. We are a podcast sponsored and hosted by casebook.org, where you can find over 70 of our roundtable discussions, author interviews, and conference talks all about Jack the Ripper, the Whitechapel murders, and Victorian true crime. We also have a discussion group on Facebook, and we're on Twitter, so you can find us at both places simply by searching for Rippercast. I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.